Welcome to today's Innovative Ideas podcast. Our guest today is Alex Tabarrok, the Bartley J. Madden Chair and Economics Professor at the Mercatus Center, as well as Associate Professor of Economics at George Mason University. Alex is also the Research Director for the Independent Institute and a Research Fellow with the Mercatus Center. He's also the author of the recent e-book, Launching the Innovation Renaissance, a new path to bring smart ideas to market fast. Alex, thanks very much for joining us today.
Great to be here.
I found this a wonderful short book to read on my Kindle. It was thought-provoking and chock-full of interesting statistics that I hadn't seen before. So I thought it was a very helpful template for understanding the challenges to innovation in the U.S. today, but also the benefits, the enormous benefits, not just to the U.S., but to the world of improving frameworks for innovation. I'd like to open by just having you talk for a few minutes about what you see as the chief challenges to innovation in the U.S. today, whether it was productivity gains or education, and how innovation can be the key to addressing some of those challenges.
Right. So, you know, my colleague has a book called The Great Stagnation, Tyler Cowen. And I think that's a useful place to begin, is that productivity growth has declined, especially if you compare the post-World War II era up until about the 1970s to what came after that. Productivity growth was considerably lower. So what are some of the ways in which we might be able to change productivity or increase productivity? I think our patent system is in need of reform. It's creating huge amounts of litigation and lots of profits for the lawyers. It's not clear that it's actually promoting the useful arts. Our education system, I think everyone recognizes that that has problems. Perhaps people don't even realize how bad it is. Maybe we can talk about that some more as well. There are a few good points as well. The globalization, I think, is helping us. But patents are a problem. We need to use other methods of increasing innovation, like prizes, perhaps. I think our education system is a problem, and there are other things as well.
The interesting thing you do, when you look at a good template or trying to find a good historical template for innovation, you reach all the way back to the Italian Renaissance that developed some of these early concepts for encouraging innovation in a population in terms of encouraging education and seeking new innovation. So can you talk a little bit about how the Florentines developed that framework?
Yeah, that was kind of a fun thing to start out the book with, because the world's first patent was given to Brunelleschi for creating the dome on the fantastic cathedral in Florence. They also gave out a prize to Brunelleschi. I guess he got a prize actually for the dome, and he got a patent for a boat. So you had the same society at exactly the same period of time creating some of the world's first prizes and patents. They also had, for the time, remarkably advanced education system. There was lots of private tutoring. There was also free public education. And there was university education nearby. And perhaps most importantly, these guys had to innovate, because Florence made all of its wealth from these wool merchants who had to bring in dyes from elsewhere in the world. They combined them with the high technology of the time, the weaving technology, and then exported. So they were very much involved in globalization and world markets, in wool. Interestingly enough, also in banking, of course, we know from the Medicis. And they adopted things like the Roman numeral system, came first in banking and accounting, and gave the Florentines a head up over their rivals, because they could keep their accounts much better using the Arabic numerals rather than the Roman numerals.
So they had a commodity, but it only gained value once it was finished, and they had to invent, bargain, trade for the technologies that would help them to exploit that resource.
Exactly right.
There's a long section of your book, and I think it's very interesting because, one, not a lot of people probably think about the U.S.'s patent system right now. It's a complex topic, but there's this ingrained sense. It's actually in the Constitution. The Constitution provides for establishing patents of some length to encourage innovation. It doesn't say how long those patents should be, but they're enshrined there. You have a terrific quote from Abraham Lincoln, who said, I think roughly paraphrasing, patents add the fuel of interest to the fire of genius. So there's this long history in America of encouraging innovation through patents, but you seem to think that we've gotten to a place where we're beyond the point of diminishing returns, because we're granting so many patents for so many broad things, we're actually deterring innovation. Could you explain your argument?
Sure. I mean, let's begin just with this idea. Why should every patentable object get a 20-year patent? That seems crazy, to give a 20-year patent to a innovative pharmaceutical where it cost, on average, $800 million to $1 billion to research and develop that pharmaceutical. So maybe you can say, yeah, 20-year patent is deserved. And we also give 20-year patents to one-click shopping, you know, Amazon's famous or infamous patent. So why do we give patents of the same length to all of these very, very different products? Moreover, it's fine to talk about, you know, I think when we're talking about patents, we're thinking about incentives to produce something. And that's absolutely right. And if we're talking about a new chair or something like that, and you want to create some incentives to produce it, okay, that's fine. But one of the areas in the economy which are most innovative right now, things like software, biotechnology, processes, business ideas, often they're what we think of as not final products, but intermediate products. They are products in which other people are going to build on. So we have a lot of accumulative innovation today, innovations which are building on other innovations. Now, patents, when you have cumulative innovation, have two effects. First, yes, they may, holding all else the same, increase the incentive to use to create the first product. But what about the second product, which is going to build on that product? Here, patents have a negative effect. Here, patents actually make it more costly to add to that innovation. They make it more costly to build innovations on top of other innovations. And we have a lot of examples of this. You know, the Wright brothers, fantastic innovators, got these patents, and they wouldn't allow other people to build on them. So Glenn Curtis, you know, and the Wright brothers got involved, all kinds of legal hassles, all kinds of lawsuits. The U.S. got so bad that innovation in the aircraft industry was completely dragged down to a halt until the government actually, for military reasons, had to step in and say, well, you know, we need to clear the board here because there's no innovation going on and we need these military planes. So that's the situation we are in today. We're trying to build products and other products, and it actually can reduce innovation.
The way I thought about this, and tell me if I'm wrong, is at least in industries where there are low costs of entry and low costs of innovating, there's not much need for patents, or patents don't add that much value or seem to add that much value. You talk a little bit about, I think, the fashion industry. There are obviously no patents in the fashion industry. The restaurant industry, there are no patents because you pay for going to taste the food at Le Bernardin, not just because they happen to make a particular dish with particular ingredients. And this makes more sense, I think, as you note, in the pharmaceutical industry, where you've got a high barrier to entry. There's actually the FDA, so they require extensive testing for market, high entry costs, high innovation costs, but then actually once you find the formula for that drug, it can be cheap pennies on the dollar to copy. So there I think it makes good sense. But you also see, and maybe you could talk about this a little bit, patent wars breaking out in the software industry between Google and other competitors who will just buy billions of dollars worth of patent bundles just to defend each other, defend themselves against patent litigation.
Yeah, it's actually gotten ridiculous. Another way of seeing this is, you know, if we have a product which requires, you know, four patents, let's say, for it to work. If each one of those patent holders demands 30% of the profits in order to go ahead with this innovation, well, we're going to have some difficulty reaching a bargain, reaching an agreement. We'll have to bargain. It's going to take some transactions costs to reach an agreement. If we have a product like a cell phone where it's built on 100 patented ideas or 1,000 patented ideas, let's say 100, and each one of them wants 10% of the profits, you know, we're going to have almost an impossible time trying to arrange a deal. Each one of them is going to try and get a bigger share of the profits at the expense of the others. It's going to be extremely costly to arrange a mutually profitable deal. So that's where all these lawsuits are coming from. And to avoid this, to avoid these lawsuits, what these big firms are doing is, as you said, buying up these patent arsenals. And they're not buying these patents in order to use the ideas. They're buying the arsenal so that if someone sues them, they can turn around and say, if you don't drop this suit, we're going to sue you right back. So the whole thing is crazy, and it looks like there's more investing going on in the lawsuits than there is being generated by the innovations themselves.
Effectively, you're spending billions of dollars to preemptively shut off lawsuits rather than taking that money and actually using it to innovate.
Exactly. So I think the patent issue is closely tied with tort reform. Another issue where the Manhattan Institute has a lot of people working on, good people. And it's this combination of giving out these patents. Another part of these patents is judges have interpreted them sometimes so broadly that you don't even know when your product is built on a patented product. You don't even know when you're violating a patent, because there can be patents, you know, filed 10, 15 years ago that no one thinks apply to you, and suddenly, you know, they jump up and you're sued. No idea that this was even possible, that such a patent even existed, or that the judges would interpret it in this way. A lot of the public thinks that when someone violates a patent and is sued for patent infringement, what they think is that the person who is being sued copied somebody else. And yet, actually copying somebody else is hardly ever even claimed in a patent lawsuit. This is not what happens. People are sued, they have the idea themselves. It's an original idea. They developed it entirely themselves without knowing anything about the patent. Then they put the product out on the market and they later discover, oh, somebody else had an idea which was like this in some way, and they get sued for it.
Has there been any turn to balance the current situation? I understand Congress recently passed President signed the America Invents Act. I understand some courts at least are beginning to rein in patent litigation and rethink some of the precedent they set back in the early 80s on these issues. Do you see the pendulum tipping a little bit back towards a more sane patent regime?
I hope so. I don't think the America Invents Act did much. It did send some more funds to the patent office, so at least they can hire more examiners. I think that was somewhat positive. But overall, there hasn't been very much decent legislation. A lot of the problems with the patent system have been created by judges acting on their own without legislation. So the way that the judges interpret the broadness of these patents, the way that the judges will take a vague patent and say that it applies, that's all been judge-driven, and it's true, it doesn't have to be that way. I was amazed, I went back, the famous Edison patent over the light bulb. So actually, there was Sawyer and Mann had developed the idea of a light bulb before Edison, but and they tried to patent any fibrous element, any plant or fibrous element used as the filament for a light bulb. And they actually sued Edison. And Edison said, look, I had to try, you know, 5,000 different products before I found that, you know, carbonized bamboo, and not just any bamboo, it happened to be bamboo from Japan, a particular kind of bamboo, worked well as a filament. And this case went to court, and the judges said, this is ridiculous. They threw out the Sawyer and Mann patent. They said, you can't patent just the idea of a fibrous element and expect that to cover everything.
You've got to
figure out which one actually works. You've got to invest some money to figure out which one actually works.
You can't find an apple that's fallen off a tree and then patent anything that's ever made from that apple.
Exactly. And yet that is the way a lot of patents are today. So, you know, people have patented genes and said, you know, any use of this gene or, you know, a business method. You know, any use of reverse auctions anywhere, anytime, you know, we've got a patent on this very vague idea. So that's the way we've gone. The judges in Edison's time did the right thing. They threw out the Sawyer and Mann patent. And I think judges ought today to act more like judges of the past.
Moving a little bit into more of a mainstream issue, as you said, there's a lot of agreement. The U.S. education system at the K-12 level is broken. I think at the university level, you put out a lot of interesting things in terms of where graduates are coming from in an economy that's increasingly becoming technologically driven, looking for math, science, engineering graduates. We're putting out many more times graduates in journalism and other fields that aren't necessarily applicable to the kind of economy that's developing, the kind of competition we're seeing in the global economy. Talk for just a minute about the links between productivity and education and, you know, some of the roadblocks we're seeing today. And what kind of solutions do we have at our fingertips to try and improve the education system?
Sure. Let me give you two remarkable facts. First, the United States is the only developed country in the world where older people actually are more likely to have had a high school education than younger people. Everywhere in the world we look, younger people are getting more and more education. As cohorts go up, the younger ones have more education. In the United States, old people, 55 to 64-year-olds, are even a little bit more likely to have had a high school education than 25 to 34-year-olds. Remarkable. Here's the second incredible fact. 25% of U.S. men do not graduate from high school. Now, how can you have a 21st century economy when a quarter of your male labor force is not graduating from high school, not college, high school. So we've got some real problems in the United States. Moreover, the quality is not great. You know, we rank quite low compared to, not just compared to like the world leaders, say mathematics, you know, Finland or South Korea. You know, we're below, you know, Denmark and Norway and Canada and New Zealand, you know, countries where we really ought to be much more competitive. And then when we do get to college, what do we see? So college, on the surface, it looks great. You got lots of kids going to college. But what do they do when they get there? Well, when they get there, a lot of them are dropping out. Only 35% of the kids who begin a four-year education actually finish in 4 years. 60% of them don't graduate within, less than 60% will graduate within 6 years. And if they haven't graduated within 6 years, they're probably not graduating at all. So overall, we have about a 40% dropout rate of college. And then I've gone on for a bit, but finally, let's talk about the point that you also made. What are the students taking when they're in college? You know, I was blown away when I found these data, but, you know, think about 25 years ago, we were graduating about 39,000 students every year in computer science, okay, 25 years ago. And you figure, well, if anything has exploded, it's got to be computers and the internet, computer science has got to be a big part of this. And yet, today, we are actually graduating fewer students in computer science than we were 25 years ago, just a little bit. It's been basically been flat. Same thing is true of chemical engineering, of electrical engineering, mechanical, math and statistics, absolutely all flat. Where have we seen huge growth? Visual and performing arts. So not only has it doubled in the past, more than doubled in the past 25 years, we're now graduating more students in the visual and performing arts than in computer science, chemical engineering, and math and statistics combined.
So why is it that we're seeing more people aspiring to go into, become Broadway stars than these other applications? Obviously, fewer jobs on Broadway, higher rewards for math and science graduates. Companies are desperate for them. What is channeling those students away from the math and sciences? Is it the K through 12 education is so bad those kids just aren't prepared?
I think that's part of it. So they find that the math and science and the statistics classes and so forth are difficult. And it is absolutely true that students in these classes, they have to study more, and they are more difficult. There's been less grade inflation. So if you want an easy A, you know, you're not going to be taking a computer science class. You're going to be taking, you know, an anthropology or psychology class, something like that. And I think when the economy was doing well, this really masked a lot of these underlying problems. So when we were booming, you know, you could still get a visual and performing arts degree and maybe not get a job in that field, but still get a pretty decent job doing something. But that, now that the economy is not so hot, and, you know, looking forward, I don't think we're going back anytime soon to quite those boom times. I think students really do have to take a lot closer look at what they're going to college for.
We're running up on our time limit here, but could you talk, I know there are lots of issues, lots of interesting solutions you propose in your book. What are the ones that would be at the top of your agenda if you were president for the day in terms of trying to incentivize and improve the framework for innovation in the U.S.? And then I'd like to kind of, you know, you conclude the book with a, I think, a rebuttal of the Malthusian argument that we live in a world of limited resources and we've got to just concentrate on redistributing what we've got today, that things are just going to keep getting harder or worse. But I think a more optimistic argument that human capital is a source of innovation, and there's no inherent limit on the number of ideas and the kinds of innovation we can get from our population.
So let's give the number one thing to improve. I think it is education. Because just imagine improving our education system today. Well, that would improve, you know, next year's students, but then the year after that, and the year after that, and the year after that, until the entire workforce would have the benefit of a better education. So I don't think there's any area in which we can do as much good as by improving the education system. What do we need to do? Well, we actually know what to do, and a lot of recent research has shown us that it's better teachers. You know, getting a better teacher in the classroom makes a huge difference. We can actually measure this today. So a better kindergarten teacher, for example, one who is in the, you know, the 75th percentile, the top quarter, as opposed to the bottom quarter, will increase the future wages of her students of a class of 20 by $320,000 annually. So you just think about doing that with better teachers year after year after year. This can make a huge difference. And I think we know how to, we can identify which teachers are better, and we just need to have the willpower to say, okay, you know, some teachers, either they've got to improve or they've got to go. We've got to make the unions to be a lot more flexible. We got to, you know, charter schools, I think, are a part of this. And we also have to pay the teachers more. That's, you know, some conservatives think that these guys are just, you know, on the dole. I don't think that at all. I think they're really important. We need to pay them more in order to attract better people into the education field. And the bargain there has got to be, we're going to pay you more, we're going to give you independence, but there's got to be accountability. You know, there's got to be accountability. You can't have this tenure after, you know, 2 or 3 years and never be fired, no matter what your performance. So higher wages, more independence, but at the price of accountability. I think that's a bargain that the unions might actually be willing to make. I think that's a place we can go.
And then last thought, a couple of days ago in the State of the Union address, the President of the State of the Union almost had a mercantilist tone in terms of saying, you know, it was like the U.S. versus China, jobs here versus jobs there, innovation here versus innovation there. I think you take a little bit of a different tact in terms of thinking about how developments and innovation globally affect quality of life in the U.S. and how the U.S., you know, stands to benefit not just from improvements in innovation here but around the world.
That's right. Globalization is the one big positive that we've seen. What I mean by that is that finally, countries like China and India are beginning to contribute to worldwide research and development. So just think about this. As late as 1990, just 7 countries in the world accounted for 94% of total worldwide research and development. And that is really beginning to change. It's China and India are educating their own people. They're contributing to ideas which benefit everyone in the world. So this is a huge, when you have another 2.5 billion people start to contribute towards the world economy, not just simply to feed themselves, which is what they've been doing for the past several centuries, but to contribute ideas to the world economy which benefit everyone, that's huge. I mean, I like to say, you know, if you invented a cure for cancer, you know, that would be great. That would be fabulous. If your neighbor invented a cure for cancer, that would be almost as good, not quite as good, but almost as good. So when China starts to do more research in developing and a cure for cancer, we ought to be happy about that. It's one of the positive signs for the world economy.
One of the things that I really like that you pointed out is increasingly affluent populations in these developing nations increase returns to innovators. So it encourages more people to bring more ideas, more products to market. And then, of course, as you said, more people who are training in the sciences and engineering, these other things, increase the supply of ideas to the world. Terrific book, very well worth reading, Launching the Innovation Renaissance, A New Path to Bring Smart Ideas to Market Fast, available on Amazon.com and also, I think, on the BNN website for the Nook. Alex, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you.